It doesn't really matter how you slice it or dice it. Vermonters drink more than the national average.
Every substance category has a unique kind of role in our society and role in our community. And long-standing, alcohol has been a really challenging substance for a lot of people, a large percentage of the population. Recent data in Vermont show us that non-fatal alcohol poisonings are much more common than non-fatal overdoses of any other substance in Vermont. And so it's a really big problem that it's important for us to not lose sight of.
Something like 80% of our people that we work with are alcohol use. It is extremely prevalent. It's prevalent in all ages. We see people that are just becoming adults and people who are in their 70s and struggling with alcohol.
Addiction is a serious public health problem across the United States. And fatal overdoses related to drugs like opioids have rightly received massive media attention and generated international public narratives about the many harms caused by addiction and substance use disorders. These conversations are messy, complex, and come with years or decades of baggage. Misunderstandings, misinformation, and outdated concepts of both the problems themselves and the health and social harms associated with addiction and substance use disorders. They also often fail to address the elephant in the room, alcohol. Each year, about 178,000 people in the United States die from excessive drinking, according to the National Institutes of Health. Alcohol use disorder increases a person's risk of unintentional injuries like car accidents, their risk of suicide, and contribute to serious health issues like cancer, heart disease, liver disease, birth defects, and developmental disabilities. I'm your host, Philip Rao. Today on Living Healthy Together, we'll sit down with experts in alcohol use disorder treatment, primary care, substance use recovery, and more, and do our best to pull back the curtain on symptoms, risk factors, advances in treatment and support, show how common struggles with alcohol misuse and addiction are across our region, and hear from a father and recovery advocate who shares his own story of struggle and success to give hope to others. We've got a ton of expertise and insight for you on today's show, and we're going to kick things off by welcoming back two substance use disorder treatment experts who can provide a fantastic launching pad for the conversation. Dr. Peter Jackson, Director of the Addiction Treatment Center at University of Vermont Medical Center, and Mallory Richardson, a certified recovery coach with Turning Point of Central Vermont, who's embedded in the emergency department at Central Vermont Medical Center, where she works with individuals across a wide range of substance use disorders. Thanks for joining us today. You've been on the show once before talking about substance use disorder, treatment and support. Today we're talking about alcohol specifically. How does alcohol fit? This is a big puzzle. There's many different pieces and it's all really complex and it's moving and our understanding is changing. Where does alcohol fit into this spectrum, this puzzle that you guys serve?
I'm really happy to hear that you guys are doing an episode focused on alcohol, Phil, because I think while we understandably and importantly focus on substance use challenges that can be the most lethal and maybe the most sort of front and center, the most acute, all substance categories continue to warrant our attention, particularly alcohol. And every substance category has a unique kind of role in our society and role in our community. And longstanding, alcohol has been a really challenging substance for a large percentage of the population, in part because it's more normalized as part of just general consumption. It's marketed immensely, so that's super challenging. Alcohol is kind of in your face so much of the time. And I think alcohol use disorders at times can seem more subtle because it's more of a normalized part of culture. And so individuals with alcohol use disorder may at times find it more difficult to seek help, more difficult to go and look for treatment and support, because they might look around themselves and say, like, gosh, all these other people around me are able to consume alcohol moderately, consume alcohol in a way that doesn't become disruptive in their lives. And so they might feel even more internal stigma or internal shame around, like, gosh, how come I'm not able to navigate this like the majority of people I see around me are able to navigate it? So it's definitely unique, and I find it valuable that you want to focus on this because I think alcohol can get lost in the shuffle.
Mallory, ground us a little bit here in how peer recovery specialists and coaches make an impact in this space. Is it different
substance to substance in terms of what peer recovery specialists do, or is it the same whether it's opioids or alcohol?
Thank you for having me here, first of all. And that's a great question. I think that the substance that someone is using is kind of irrelevant. There's definitely different paths depending on which substance you're using, but it's more so dependent on the person. Each individual is going to respond differently to different kinds of treatment and different kinds of support. And I think as a recovery coach, one of the benefits that I have is I am a peer. I've been through it. I've been through addiction on both sides. And I think that being able to have that understanding really helps people trust us to be able to be a voice of grounding in everything that's going on right now.
From 2023 to now, there's been a significant decrease in the number of people who say they drink and a significant increase in the number of people who say that even drinking in moderation is bad for your health. What we're talking about here is a little bit different, right? Drinking being bad for your health and drinking being a substance use problem, are these two different things? Are they two sides of the same coin? Or am I being silly and trying to dice these up in a way that doesn't make sense?
Increasingly, we're seeing science that tells us that alcohol is bad for your health, kind of across different levels of substances. And as a substance use provider, I hope that the messaging is getting out in a way that's about healthcare and isn't about sort of making this a moral issue or a characterological issue. It is very different to think about alcohol use disorder versus problematic health impacts of alcohol use. Those are two different things. And I think messaging around both of them is really important. And I think it's fair to think about it in two different contexts. Particularly when I work with people in clinic, I'm working with people who have come because they're recognizing significant problems, not just healthcare impact, but problems in other areas of their life that meet criteria for an alcohol use disorder. I've had people talking with me about feeling frustrated, like they've been almost taken advantage of by the intense marketing around alcohol. And I think the marketing is such that alcohol is sort of described as making almost any event better. So whatever holiday it is, birthday parties, anniversaries, weddings, whatever celebration, alcohol is going to make that better. And I think for many people, it doesn't make it better. In fact, makes it worse. So I think people are kind of getting tired of that messaging, tired of that sort of pressure around alcohol being part of things. Recent data in Vermont show us that non-fatal alcohol poisonings are much more common than non-fatal overdoses of any other substance in Vermont. And so it's a really big problem that it's important for us to not lose sight of.
That is shocking data. So along with that, are you seeing at the Addiction Treatment Center more folks coming in seeking treatment and or support for alcohol-related issues in their lives?
I don't know that we've seen a difference in the overall percentage, but I do think that we're seeing people, and this is one of the greatest hopes that I have as a provider, is that we see people coming in sooner for substance use treatment. So maybe they're coming in sooner chronologically, meaning they're not waiting as long, and they might also be coming in sooner in the course of what can develop into an alcohol use disorder, sort of earlier in the severity of substance use disorder.
Mallory, what about at Turning Point and in your capacity working as a recovery coach embedded in a hospital emergency department? Are you seeing more folks come in with alcohol-related concerns and in need of support?
I think that the statistics on it are something like 80% of our people that we work with are alcohol use. It is extremely prevalent. It's prevalent in all ages. We see people that are just becoming adults and people who are in their 70s and struggling with alcohol.
How have the one-on-one conversations grown or changed over the course of your career? Maybe even now our interactions on a broad scale with alcohol are changing. And depending on what data you look at, they might be changing pretty rapidly, or opinions might be changing pretty rapidly. Is the way that we talk with people who are seeking help different now than it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago? Are there different things to say?
In a clinical conversation, I don't think things have changed that much, but I do hope that in our public conversation, things are changing. I think a lot of people don't recognize that Many people choose not to consume alcohol just for their health to decrease the risk of developing a substance use disorder. I think recent statistics in Vermont are only about 60% of people have consumed alcohol in the past 30 days. But if you look at the marketing, you wouldn't realize or you wouldn't think that there's a huge percentage of people that just that aren't really consuming alcohol much at all. And I think sometimes that group can be sort of overshadowed. In my individual conversations, people are kind of exhausted at times by how much this is sort of like pressed as this needs to be part of your celebration.
You've been doing this for a number of years now. You got plenty of visibility into where we've been and where we are right now. Where do we need to go to? Are there high value investments around support and treatment for folks struggling with alcohol use disorder that should be made locally or regionally? Are there things that you come across in your day-to-day work as a recovery coach that you say, ah, I really wish we had X, Y, and Z?
Yes, so many things. I think there's definitely some gaps in services. Sober housing is one of them. Step-down programs are one of them. A lot of our participants will go to treatment, which includes rehab. And if you're on Medicaid, which a lot of people are, rehab is a two-week thing. It's not 28 days. It's not a month. And that's barely enough to get through detox if you're someone who is using substances. And if you're someone who's using alcohol, usually they'll have you go to the hospital or somewhere else to detox first, just because I didn't touch on that. But yes, you can die from alcohol withdrawals very easily. I think people, especially if they're hiding it from their family and are trying to cut down, it can be incredibly, incredibly dangerous.
I don't know. Maybe I am just one of the few that didn't realize that, but that was really shocking and sobering to me. No pun intended. I had no idea. And I wonder how many other folks don't know that.
Not every addict is the same, but when you're using street drugs and fentanyl and crack and stuff that you just don't really know what it is, the chances of you dying are immediate. So you could score and use and die. And with alcohol, I think it takes a lot longer, but it definitely is a deadly disease. They both are deadly. And it is shocking. I wouldn't even recommend someone, if they're a heavy, heavy, heavy drinker, I would absolutely suggest that they go to a professional if they're going to stop, because you can have seizures and you can die if you just try to do it at home, and it's incredibly dangerous.
I think it is really important to know, and because alcohol is so common and because it's marketed so much, I think people don't know as much about the risks. Alcohol withdrawal is among the most dangerous types of withdrawal, much more dangerous actually than opioid withdrawal. So opioid withdrawal, you know, absolutely miserable. People experience a lot of symptoms and feel very, very, very sick, but it's very unlikely to die from opioid withdrawal. While alcohol use and other sedative hypnotics like benzodiazepines, the withdrawal process can be really dangerous. I talk to patients at times thinking of it as sort of like our body's trying to achieve balance in our neurological system, and alcohol and other sedatives being downers, our body's compensation for that is to turn up the nervous system, so to speak. And so when alcohol is withdrawn abruptly, if it's being consumed at high amounts, that depressant effect on our nervous system is now gone, but our body doesn't compensate quite quickly enough to turn down its own mechanisms that have been trying to balance against the depressant effect of alcohol. So our nervous system is essentially turned up really high, is very activated, and that can lead to seizure and hallucinations and other really acute complications. And yeah, alcohol withdrawal can be lethal. So it's really an important message for people to know. Recognizing the need for patients in the early stages of alcohol use disorder. So somebody comes in that's drinking heavily, and the message to them is not, okay, you have to stop right now. We talk with people about the risks and the benefits. There are medically supported withdrawal treatments. I wish we had more of those available in the state, but in an inpatient setting, you can safely stop drinking alcohol if you have medical support to do it. And there are some protocols that can be done in the outpatient setting. But for the most part, we're working with people to find them intensive medical support if their goal is to stop right away. Otherwise, they need to go through a process of gradually tapering down.
Really troubling data, troubling information about the severity of alcohol use disorder and alcohol withdrawal and the risks it poses to folks who are heavy drinkers. Thank you, Mallory. Thank you, Dr. Jackson, for joining us and kicking off this discussion. It's time for a quick break here on Living Healthy Together. When we come back, you'll hear from a Vermonter who struggles with alcohol use for the defining factor in his personal and professional lives for years, and learn how and why he made the decision to make a change. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Living Healthy Together, where we're digging in on alcohol use disorder and its challenges and impacts across our region. We're joined now by Chris Collins of Washington, Vermont. Chris, thanks for joining us today and being willing to share your story. We've heard from a couple experts already, Dr. Peter Jackson and Mallory Richardson, who you actually worked with during your recovery, who have helped set the table in terms of public health, statistics, and specific challenges. But you're here to help us go deeper and see this from a personal impacts perspective.
When did alcohol become a negative presence in your life?
Basically, at the introduction of alcohol into my life, it was a negative. But, you know, I'd say early 20s, I was involved in a motorcycle accident and was basically disabled for life after that. But for quite some time, not out of work and stuff. And, you know, that was kind of a go-to, leaned on type of situation for a while. I was 20 years old and I had just bought my first sport bike. It was the GSXR 750, and I left my place of employment to go pick it up on my lunch break because I wanted to show it off to my coworkers and stuff. And on the way back, I was hit by a car doing a illegal U-turn and suffered some pretty extensive injuries.
Did you start drinking because you were struggling with your recovery, or was it just that time in everybody's life?
When I first started drinking alcohol, I was 17, 18 years old, you know, and just had switched schools. And back then it was like a social acceptance type of thing. I didn't have any friends in the new area and I wasn't quite in but certain crowds. And so I picked one basically, and alcohol was definitely part of that. I'd start by trying to drink beer, and I didn't even have a taste for it, but I wanted to be socially accepted. And the social scene from there, you know, gaining acceptance and new group of friends, and I was just figuring out that it was fun.
So this is a part of your life, and then this accident happens. How did that change things for you? Did alcohol accompany you through that, or did you kind of switch off all of your social stuff and focus on recovery after the accident?
You know, I had a lot of nerve damage, basically no use in my right arm, and I was right-handed. So I had some serious problems, and I was an electrician at the time. So that was over. I was hit by an uninsured motorist. So there was no big payouts or anything. And I had $30,000+ worth of medical bills. You know, looking back, I can't even sit there and say I remember every detail of it. No, it was stressful figuring out how to write and drive. I had a manual shift car, but I got through it. And I try not to fall into a state of being depressed about it. And alcohol certainly was something I leaned on to keep me going, and in a negative way, definitely negative way, but, you know, kept my social status and with my friends and tried to make the best of it. And at the same time, I was having a family. I just, on the same day of my accident, found out that I was having a daughter. Same day, the mother was finding out that we were pregnant. So there was a lot going on, and having alcohol there was, at the time, it was like a crutch to get through, but definitely just a downward spiral.
My gosh, I mean, a lot going on. That might be the understatement of the year so far. How did you find the mental fortitude? Losing your career, a physical limitation, and relearning how to write. That's relearning how to live your life to a large extent. How did you deal with that?
Knowing that I had a daughter coming was really the only thing that really probably kept me above water, you know, knowing that I had that responsibility coming. And then 2 years later, finding out a son was coming, you know, I think looking back, God put some responsibilities in my way that I couldn't say no to, you know? And so I think that is the only thing that comes to my mind that really kept me going 100%.
You have kind of this dichotomy, these amazing life moments, having a daughter, having a son, but you also talk about a downward spiral. How did that happen while you have all this other good stuff going on too?
The downward spiral would continue with the alcohol, moving on to, you know, this was 20 plus years ago. So, you know, we talk about a little like drugs, selling a little pie, trying to keep some income going to take care of stuff. That's definitely a negative way to live, but it's something we can talk about now. But, you know, it's negative downward spiral as far as income, and then just the nightlife, so to speak, going out, not being prepared for the next day 100%. Then your work starts to slip. Your kids start to get a little bit older, so they're not so needing your attention 100%. And the downward spiral just chips away at you so slowly, you don't even really realize how far down the rabbit hole you're going year after year.
It's that old metaphor, right? You throw a frog into boiling water, he's going to jump right out. But you put a frog in some room temperature water and you slowly turn up the temperature, and that frog will sit there until it's too late.
Adapt. You'll adapt to it. And not only will you adapt to it, I learned to thrive in it. You know, I was always the guy that would show up with a cooler full of fruit and booze all mixed in and mixing drinks, and then became a bartender and made a small career, side career out of it, you know.
How did that work for you? Did you get the full use of your right hand or your right arm back?
No, I went through a lot of electric shock therapy, nerve regeneration, met with teams down in Dartmouth. 7 years later, I had the hardware removed out of my shoulder. I had a plate with 13 screws in it in my shoulder for 7 years, which became very hard to deal with. So they took that out. What happened is the tire of the car crushed my shoulder and crushed my collarbone, severed my brachial plexus, which is your main stream of nerves from your spine to your arm. So basically, so much damage 20 plus years ago. So basically, I just learned how to do things with one arm as best I could, and I've come a long way. A lot of people that meet me now take some while to even notice, depending on the situation. Obviously, they don't see me behind a bar anymore. So it's just something you learn to adapt, like you said, with the frog. I was the frog.
Talk about becoming a bartender. Did that exacerbate your struggles with alcohol use? How did that change things for you?
There was about a 5 to 6 year block between my accident and me becoming a bartender. I did other things. I was in the auto industry, sold cars for a while. That was not very demanding of my right arm. Again, learning to write left-handed. I now write right-handed again after a lot of therapy and stuff. But so I had some time to figure out this injury. It's not like I jumped right into another thing. So a lot of years of adapting, figuring stuff out. But it was a huge negative, because just being really in the lifestyle and then making all these acquaintances, and, you know, they're paying your bills. So you're buddies and friends with these people, which, you know, a lot of them are great people. Some of them aren't, but it's a fishbowl and you work with it, work with everyone. And then you find yourself, well, the next day you're hanging out at the bar all of a sudden, and you're sitting at the wrong side and hanging out with these people that just paid your week's income by hanging out. So you want to hang out with them because they're cool, and you're cool because you're the one serving them drinks. So it's just a great time, and you don't think much of it in the time.
It's time for a break here on Living Healthy Together. When we come back, we'll have more with Chris on his journey and his message to those going through similar struggles. Don't go anywhere. We'll be back after this.
Welcome back to Living Healthy Together as we spotlight alcohol use disorder in our region. We're here with a Vermonter, Chris Collins, who's sharing his story of recovery. Chris, when we went to break, you were talking about becoming a bartender some years after a catastrophic motor vehicle crash left you with severe damage to your right arm and hand.
It's a great time at work. Was it still a great time at home? Did it ever start to negatively impact your personal life?
I think the appropriate question is, when did it not? It immediately had a negative impact. It led to the failure of a marriage, the kids obviously going without the presence of a parent that they would have had. I mean, the parent that I am now versus the parent that I was 10 years ago, we're talking completely different, you know? So yes, there was huge negative effects from the very start, but when you're in the moment, you're in that environment, you don't see it until you pull yourself out of it. And it takes a long time to really pull yourself out of it 100%. And looking back now at 46 years old versus, you know, we're talking back when I was 27, 28 years old, becoming a bartender. If I could say anything to that person, you know, I don't know. It'd be an interesting conversation to try to get through to my young self.
When did the switch flip for you? Because like you said, you have to want to help yourself. You have to want to get better and to do something different. And sometimes it's a gradual thing. Sometimes it's a light bulb coming on. What was it for you and when did it happen?
Over the years of my reckless lifestyle, I was creeping up on 300 pounds. And so obviously 100 pounds overweight. I ended up losing my father and my grandfather in the same year back in 2015. And, you know, a light went off for me to get healthy. Now, when I say healthy, we did not quit drinking. I did put drinking aside for a while. This was maybe 8.5 to 9 years ago. I just decided that I was going to get in better shape. And I did. I lost 100 pounds. I put drinking aside for a while, but I allowed it back into my life thinking, oh my gosh, I have lost 100 pounds. I'm a better father. My relationships are doing better. My careers are doing better. And yeah, I will maybe do a little wind. You know, we're different now. We're better. And that's just opening up the rabbit hole again. And it took about a year of that behavior to just start getting into my relationships again. And then it just, again, continues a downward spiral into your family. And then the next thing you know, you're up 30 pounds, 40 pounds. Your relationships aren't doing well again. Your career's not doing well again. And you're back to your negative lifestyle. And what takes you 8 years to accomplish takes you about a 6 month window to just say goodbye to. And you allow it. You allow it. And that's the worst part is you justify it. And you think it's going to be okay.
You had folks in your life that had seen you go through this spiral once. Did they start sounding alarm bells through the process? Did your kids, your family, your loved ones say, whoa, 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 Chris?
There was a lot of things like that, but I'll just get down to the one thing. When your kids are right in front of you and confront you and tell you right to your face that you're lying to them again and they're not going to watch it. If you don't recognize that your children are telling you, then I really pray for you, because that was all it took for me. I was done after that, 100%. That's what it took for me. There was plenty of stuff before that. Like I said, I laid on my deathbed so polluted with alcohol that thankfully the doctors that I saw had the courage and knowledge enough to basically save my life when I was in the ER. I went through all of that, and that was definitely eye-opening and definitely made me quit for almost a year. But I still went back after that for a hot minute, and it took my family saying that to me to just say, that's it.
This is a case of alcohol poisoning that brought you into the ER in a life-threatening situation. Tell me what happened here.
When I was getting off my mower, I slipped and fell and I hit my leg and I had some bruising, but my blood was so thin. that I had some internal bleeding that I just ignored because I was like, oh, it's just a bruise. It'll go away. Oh, my leg's sore. It'll be fine. Well, no, it wasn't fine. I had blood clots that made it to my lungs and were on their way to my heart. And I thankfully was taken just in time and got the scene by the doctors when I did and pulled through. And with the grace of God, I'm here today.
You have this moment with your kids. What was it like hearing them confront you?
Very thankful that they had the courage to do so. It was unexpected, but that's all it took. I'm very, very thankful that I have the family that I do. It took me basically in my recliner, and I had to basically get through the recovery part myself. No meetings, no nothing. I just did it.
You did it all yourself. You did it all cold turkey yourself. Oh my gosh.
When I left the hospital, my blood was very, very dangerously thin. I still had blood clots, but it still needed to be thin to move the clots. And so I had to inject myself with shots in my stomach twice a day to keep my blood thin enough. By the end of 2 weeks, my stomach was so black and I could not inject myself in another spot. And I was working so hard to get to a pill form so I could be safe enough just to take this pill rather than the injections. And the last shot that I took to my stomach, I could not administer myself because it was so painful and I was crying so badly. Fighting through that, along with all the other, that wasn't even the hardest thing. The hardest thing is the family and the mental thing and knowing that you'd done it to yourself. I think that was the hardest thing for me, was knowing that I did it to myself. Yes, I did have it fall, and it wasn't 100%. The reason why I was there was alcohol, but it was 100% why I couldn't recover as quickly. So yeah, it was alcohol and owning it. If you can't own it at that point, then whatever you need to do to figure out how you can start owning it in small doses is what you need to do.
Mallory Richardson from Turning Point, I believe you worked with her. When did you start finding these other supports that could help you through this process?
My first support that really turned on a light bulb in my head was John Reese from Turning Point Recovery Coach. I did not choose to recover fully that day, but I'll tell you what, that was the day that I decided that I needed to recover. Hearing him and his story, that was so like mine, it hit home with me. And he was just a nice guy. And I talked to him after I left the hospital. And that was an ER visit due to anxiety, because I went to the hospital a few times dealing with anxiety because of alcohol use disorder. Mallory was involved after my last hospital stay that we had just talked about. And another one was my primary, Marissa Patrick. She took really good notice in my needs, and I was open with her. And that's another thing I would encourage. I want to say, be honest with your doctors. If you're not going to be honest with them, you can't be honest with yourself. Me being able to be honest with her after a while was very helpful. That's when I really started to get help from my primary, when I was able to be honest with them. And then Marissa had referred me to speak to Paul Brody. So I spoke to Paul Brody after my hospital stay and after my initial part of my recovery that we were talking about that I did myself. I then started to go to just a once a week counseling session with Paul, either via text or in person or via phone. And his sessions were very helpful because he was just very down to earth, very low pressure. I think those supports for me in the final stages of my, you know, recovery were very beneficial for me.
Why did you want to come on the show and talk today? These are not easy things to talk about. It can be embarrassing. It can be traumatizing.
It's embarrassing. It's hard to say, you know. That's why I want to say it. That's why I want to be embarrassed, because it is embarrassing and you don't have to go through it. I always thought to myself, what am I going to do without alcohol in my life? How am I going to have fun? What am I going to do for extracurricular activities? I'm going to lose this group of friends and they're great people. What am I going to do? They're not going to like me. Well, you know what? If they don't like you and you're going to laugh they weren't your friends to begin with. Your parents always said that. Well, the proof is in the pudding, my friend. If you pull yourself out of an environment and these friends don't pick up the phone to check on you or to text you and say, hey, how you doing? Or they see you haven't been around in a while. And you say, well, I had some medical complications because of my lifestyle and I need to make some changes. So I haven't been around because I really need to do this. If they don't support you, then that's okay. It's okay. Maybe they'll come around. I've had a lot of people not support me in the beginning and they look at me now and they see I'm healthy, living a decent life, and my kids are healthy and doing well. And they've come around and I've actually helped a handful of people quit drinking 100%. And I'm so, so proud of that. And, you know, maybe I can help a couple more. So I don't care about being embarrassed. Yeah, it's embarrassing, but it's not embarrassing today. I can tell you that. It was embarrassing 5, 8, 10 years ago, but it hasn't been embarrassing for 2.5 years. I can tell you that, my friend.
That's a great place to leave it with you, Chris. Thanks so much for sharing your experiences and insights. It's been a real pleasure having you on the show today. When we come back on Living Healthy Together, we'll welcome two experts from Central Vermont's unique system of treatment and support for substance use disorders and hear more about the primary care pathway to alcohol use disorder treatment and support that helped Chris on his journey of recovery. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Living Healthy Together. We're talking with experts today about alcohol, alcohol use, and alcohol use disorder across our region. And joining us now, Eva Zaret, a public health specialist at Central Vermont Medical Center and the program manager of Central Vermont Prevention Coalition, and Marissa Patrick, an adult primary care nurse practitioner with Central Vermont Medical Center in Barre, Vermont, and the architect of the hospital's primary care treatment pathway for individuals with alcohol use disorder. You've both been on the show before. You're both experts in this field, and we're happy to have you back. Let's start by talking about alcohol use in our region. What is the landscape that we're looking at right now? One statistic from the Vermont Department of Health, their substance use dashboard, 16% of adults binge drank in 2023. Where does that put our region in the broad scheme of things?
Vermont is actually the number two state in the United States with the highest rates of alcohol consumption. We definitely are at the top when we're looking at data, which is what really drove us in our work to improve the treatment of alcohol use disorder. Nationally, 29 million adults in the United States have alcohol use disorder. Less than 10% ever receive any treatment, and only about 2% receive medication treatment. And medication treatment is very effective, but underutilized. Many people don't realize that there are options to treat alcohol use disorder with medications.
And I want to be clear, the statistic I gave is specifically binge drinking, which is different than just alcohol use. There's alcohol use, there's alcohol use disorder, and binge drinking. These are all three different things. They mean very specific things. Can you ground people in what we're talking about in each of these instances?
It doesn't really matter how you slice it or dice it. Vermonters drink more than the national average. You could have drinking at all, like just the percentage of Vermonters who drink is higher than the average U.S. adult. The Vermonters who report heavy drinking, so that's 2 drinks a day for men or 1 for women, is higher. And then the binge drinking, which is several drinks in a short amount of time, is higher. And it's not just adults. We also know that our young people, our youth, are drinking at high levels as well.
And when you go to your primary care provider or you go to the emergency department, any sort of medical place, a lot of times we do a screening for alcohol use. And then based on that screening, it will kind of land you into one of those areas, whether it's unhealthy alcohol use or if it is a true alcohol use disorder. And then we use specific criteria from the DSM-5, which is a way to diagnose people with the alcohol use disorder. But ultimately, alcohol is not a healthy substance, and it has significant increased risk of cancer, specifically when consuming alcohol. So even if you are not drinking it to a point where you have alcohol use disorder, I think it's important to recognize the effects of alcohol and how that impacts your body. So about a year ago, the Surgeon General came out with a warning specifically noting the risk of cancer. And I think the purpose of that was to really provide that information and inform the public about the cancer risk, because many people were not aware of that. And so with that information, we can make informed decisions about what we consume and not consume.
That screening, is that something that's available to anyone? They can talk to their PCP, their primary care provider, and say, hey, I want to have a conversation about drinking, or hey, I want to know about my own drinking habits.
Absolutely. Yeah. So part of everyone's annual visit with their primary care provider, we do a screening for alcohol use in primary care. In the past few years, we've been really focusing on improving the treatment of alcohol use disorder. And we recognized that a lot of people were being screened for alcohol use in primary care, but providers weren't always sure what to do next if someone screened positive. So that's why we developed a primary care alcohol use treatment pathway, which helps guide providers from screening all the way through treatment options, including medication, counseling, and recovery support. And the most important piece of all of this is that it's flexible and patient-centered. Every person is different. So depending on what they need, we can offer them different options. It's really important that we recognize not everyone is going to be ready to stop drinking, but we can help them reduce their drinking so it's safer and improve and their health outcomes are better long-term. We really need to be treating alcohol use just like we do any other chronic condition in primary care. And people can definitely go to their primary care provider and ask about their alcohol use and start that conversation. I think that's the best way to start, is just simply talk to your PCP about what you're questioning and what you're doing.
I certainly didn't realize that there was medication to help with this. Is there any more to say about what this primary care treatment pathway is, how it works, what it looks like to patients and providers?
It was really created to help providers know what resources and options are available to patients that screen positive and what medications are available in response to that data that I shared earlier about how only 2% of people nationally receive medication treatment for alcohol use disorder. So when I created that pathway, my goal was to change that number here in Vermont. And so hopefully more people are being prescribed medication to help them either reduce their alcohol use, or if they choose to abstain, that they can abstain and then continue, recognizing that relapses do occur.
So this is a pathway that was created by you and put in place at CVMC for a period of time before now being adopted across UVM Health as a system. So it's in Vermont, it's in Northern New York. How long has it been active, and are the conversations with patients changing? Is this new way of bringing light to this having an impact?
We started this project really back in 2020 in the emergency department, improving access to care within the emergency department, because during the pandemic, we noticed an increase in alcohol use. And specifically in the emergency department, there was an increased number of patients presenting in acute withdrawal from alcohol or asking for treatment. And in the past, we would treat their withdrawal, but then when they were discharged, they weren't discharged with any sort of follow-up care. And we recognized that was a gap. And so we first started in the emergency department, improving the treatment, and then also developing a plan for ongoing care. And we connected patients at discharge. We started them on medications, and then we connected them with ongoing care outpatient, either with their primary care provider or with a specialty clinic. The Center for Substance Use Services here in Central Vermont became one of our main kind of intensive outpatient treatment centers. And then we recognized that most people wanted to follow up with their primary care provider from the emergency department. They felt most comfortable going to see their PCP rather than going to a specialty clinic. And that's when we started this primary care pathway. We reached out to all the primary care providers to gather some information about what was already being offered for treatment, and then how can we improve the treatment? And we've also continued to do continuing education. Actually, earlier today, I did a presentation to primary care providers on how to treat alcohol use disorder, which includes information about all of the medications that can be used. And recovery coach support, I think, is incredibly important and a very valuable resource to kind of help connect all the dots.
Eva, what about the conversation in the community and among community-based support services? Is there new ground being broken, or are we still dealing with the same stuff that we've been dealing with for years?
People are ready to talk about alcohol, and they're ready to address it, I think. You know, in 2021, there were around 210 opioid-related fatalities, and there were almost 450 deaths in Vermont related to alcohol. So the consequences and the impact of alcohol cannot be underestimated or understated. It's so critical. And community partners are ready to work on this issue. EMS says all the time, alcohol is the number one substance that we deal with. The emergency department feels the same way. Programs that provide services to unsheltered or unhoused people are experiencing a lot of alcohol use. And we need to refocus attention, resources, effort on this substance because it's having a real impact on our communities. I think people are seeing it. So we're resurrecting those conversations in Central Vermont after quite a while of focus on opioids. We have some great treatment pathways, and I think it's created some momentum to think about what other services are missing in the system of care for people for alcohol use, and how do we make sure that we can get those into place.
We heard earlier in the show from Chris Collins, a Vermonter who's struggled mightily with alcohol use and alcohol use disorder for many, many years. Marissa, I know Chris is a patient of yours and you've worked with him for a long time. What is the piece of his story that sticks in your mind when we talk about this topic?
I think what he's overcome is incredible. And to see where he came from, and he was really quite sick and ended up inpatient in the hospital. And then I met him after he was discharged and have followed him since, to see that change is just amazing. And he is definitely someone who's just an inspiration, I think, to everyone to show that anything is possible and you can make a positive change and become a very healthy person.
Any closing thoughts, anything we haven't talked about that you think it's important for people to hear?
I think the most important thing is to start this conversation. And whether it be with your primary care provider, or it could even be friends and family, like talking about our alcohol use and how does that impact our lives.
When we talk about alcohol, we're often framing it as a matter of personal choice or responsibility. And from the public health perspective, it's also about the environment that we've created around alcohol. And that's a really big part of the influence that we have in Vermont specifically. Alcohol is really available. It's heavily marketed. It's really normalized within our communities. It's at celebrations, social events, even in some cases, professional settings. And when it's the default, it's shaping our behavior. It takes effort to opt out. So that's not really an individual issue. It's the systems that we live with and are influencing our behavior. We have relationships around us, family, friends, social circles. There's the community around us, what's encouraged, what's normal. And then we have broader systems like policies or pricing or marketing. So our choices are not being made in a vacuum. They're being shaped by all of these different layers that are interacting around us at once. So there's a lot of things that we can do in addition to being made aware of treatment options or giving people information. We can look at those other levels. And when we enact interventions at those levels, in addition to giving information, that's when we can be most successful. So, for example, research shows that if we could enact even a very small increase in alcohol tax, we could reduce alcohol drinking, decrease underage drinking, prevent injuries, and there's a significant decrease in deaths. this is just one example of the ways that we can be thinking beyond the individual. And I really hope that we can marry the clinical part and the public health part to be coming together to create environments in which people can be healthier.
I hope you've enjoyed this conversation as much as I have. There's so much to discuss on this issue, and we just scratched the surface. Thanks to Chris Collins, Dr. Peter Jackson, Mallory Richardson, Eva Zaret, and Marissa Patrick. And if you're listening to the podcast version of this episode, don't forget to subscribe for those easy automatic downloads where a new episode goes live every week. I'm your host, Philip Rao. We'll see you next time.